Hello and welcome to Wax Lyrical, the advertising and marketing podcast from Wax On and the Marketing Society. I'm Mark Renicus, and Karen Harry and Paul Jacobs will be joining me by Zoom for another of our special Business as Unusual podcast episodes. And today we've got a couple of really fascinating guests. Marketing Society CEO Gemma Greaves tells us how her members are responding to the current situation. And then we're joined by behavioural scientist Dr. Simon Moore to talk about the psychology of consumer behaviour in these strange times. But first, I spoke to Gemma Greaves, who became CEO of the Marketing Society in 2017. But she's been with the Society now for 14 years, joining in 2006 as their marketing director. I started my conversation with Gemma by asking about the mood of the Society's members at the moment.
I think the mood is an interesting one, actually, in that the word I would use is conflicted. And actually, I've been talking to a lot of our members, and that's what that's the general sentiment that I've got. Conflicted because, obviously, we're talking from a personal and a professional point of view. Personally, many of us are quite daunted right now as the scale as to what's happening at the moment. None of us have ever experienced anything quite like it. So we're all learning every day, and we all don't know what's happening. We can listen to the media, we can listen to people around us, but really we don't know. It's a bit of an unknown. So I think we're feeling anxious. I think people are feeling anxious, daunted, and a little bit worried. But if you think about from a personal point of view, many of us have got older relatives. Personally, I'm worried about my parents. They're in that over 70 bracket, and they're, you know, needing to be isolated for 4 months. And I think many of us are in that boat. So I say conflicted because you've got that side in terms of that anxiety and that feeling of, you know, the scale and feeling daunted by it all, but also the opportunity that is available to us right now. And again, what we're learning every day. So I think there's so much opportunity through this situation that we're already seeing at the Marketing Society, and we're already seeing our members seeing, that actually there's a lot of positivity and optimism in our community. So that's why I say conflicted, because I think we've got that anxiety, but we're also feeling quite positive about the opportunity that's available and learning new things.
I think the leadership issue is really important. And I'm not just saying this, but I've noticed you are demonstrating great leadership. So thank you for that. And it's not always easy to do that. And do you know what? I think there are a couple of organisations that are doing that too. And I wondered if you'd seen some examples where a brand is actually doing something really positive that we can all learn from.
I think the best leaders are the ones that are showing strength, showing positivity, but being honest that we don't have all the answers. And that's what we're trying to do at the Marketing Society is, you know, we want to provide a reassuring community for people to come together and to help and to learn and to get inspired and keep connected. And that's where I'm seeing the leadership coming through that's really powerful. The ones that are much more, you know, and I think that's the way just generally with leadership, it's the human leaders that are the ones that are really shining a light. And I'm really seeing that come through. And it's the ones that are being the opposite of that, that are failing and their companies are struggling a wee bit.
We've talked quite a bit about the importance of focusing on our well-being, and certainly staying in touch is an important part of that. How are you empowering everybody in the Marketing Society to keep in touch?
Sharing the things that we are pivoting to, in a sense. So the first thing is we've set up WhatsApp groups in all of our hubs across Hong Kong, Singapore, London, Scotland, etc. And that's already having a really positive effect. And those WhatsApp groups are purely to keep us connected, for us to be able to share what we're all doing, to support each other, number one, and also provide a bit of humour, because in these times, you know, just like any times, but particularly right now, it's important to have fun and to laugh. And our members are a brilliant community, and they're really doing that. So the first thing is a WhatsApp group. The second is we run 120 events globally, physically. So you can imagine right now, it's an interesting time for us. Mm. So we've had to pivot, and we've had to pivot at pace. And so you already have seen some of the webinars and things that we've started to produce. And actually, that in itself is not easy, because to create an event and to run an event, you know, it takes a lot of time. A couple of the events that we've done, we've literally done in 24 hours, because we need to be leading the way forward, and we need to be providing content and community for our members. So the big thing that we're launching at the moment is series using the power of our community, utilizing the power of our community. The first one is, you know, as a team, we started talking about, you know, keep calm and carry on, that famous World War II slogan. So we've adapted it slightly to keep calm, and then it's get creative, get connected, get inspired, get motivated. And there's a weekly session. Ideally, we're trying to do them on Wednesdays on hump day to get us over the week. And this session is designed to bring us together, to enable us to think about how we can manage our energy, how we can feel a bit more motivated, and give us some tools right now that we can use at home in our new normal. We're tapping into the incredible wealth of speakers we have globally, asking them to do kind of TED-style bite-sized bravery for our members, and that series will be coming out soon. We're also curating our existing content. So Mike, our editor, who's brilliant, and I know you know him very well, he is currently compiling a sort of bumper edition of the edit, where we're curating lots of the things we've been up to globally. And our edit is our way of curating the content across our community for our members that we think is interesting, and we, you know, crowdsourced and our members find interesting. And that's having a really positive impact. And we're also lifting some of the content that we've already got over the years, the archived content, and curating that for our members on a weekly content bulletin.
Let's look forward a little bit. Do you think that some of the behaviours that we have adopted at the moment will continue afterwards?
Yeah, I think we're moving into a new normal. I'm not saying we'll all be wanting to stay in our house 24/7. I certainly won't. I need to get out there again. But I genuinely think that we're all learning how to work from home in an effective and an efficient way. And work will change forever, I believe. And for the good as well. And it's finding that balance. And I think more leaders will realise it's not about time put in. So the conversation we were having earlier in terms of taking breaks, it's not about time, it's about output, and it's about having trust with your teams to be accountable and to achieve great things. And they can do that within the flexibility that works for them within their lifestyle and for all of us. And I think that flexibility, that output-led opportunity will really start to come to the fore, because we've all learned how to do it, and to do it in an efficient way, and we're learning all the time. I think that will really change the way we work, which has got to be a good thing, because we need to find more flexible ways of working, and we need to be more understanding. And for me, it's about how can you work with your team? How can you work as a leader to get the best out of your people, for them to be at their best more of the time, and for us as leaders to be at our best more of the time? And these new ways, I think, are enabling that in a big way. And out of this, I think we're going to see a lot of positivity and opportunity.
I think, and I hope, that one of the things that will continue, and I'm going to use your word, is I think we are being kinder to each other as work colleagues. You talked about how you are asking people how they are, and you actually really mean it now. And I hope that continues. I certainly have noticed that every call I have, every Zoom I have, somebody says, no, how are you? How are you coping with it? And I think we have reconnected with each other as humans in a much more authentic way. And long may that continue.
Couldn't agree more, but I also think that we've been on that journey for quite some time. You know, when we started the Brave Agenda, which you know, as you know, started when I became chief exec back in 2017, the first learning was, for me personally, it's okay to be myself, and that means being my true self. The second learning was, it's okay not to be okay, as the brilliant Ruby Wax said at one of our events. And actually, when you look through that lens with your team, you start to have much bigger conversations and create those comfortable spaces to have those more uncomfortable conversations. So for a long time as a team, we've not just been saying, how are you? We've been saying, how are you really? You know, and one of the things that I did with my team that was really good, and I'd recommend this with everyone, and you could do it virtually now as well, is get everyone to write on a big post-it note, and you could do it virtually, so figure out the way to do that virtually. But the one thing that you can do to help create a safe space in the workplace, obviously a virtual workplace now, because yes, there's a lot of emphasis on leaders and our well-being, but actually every single one of us can do something. So if everyone thinks about one thing they can do to create a safe space and is honest about it, then actually you can really start to have such more, much bigger and powerful conversations. One of my team said, I'll be honest with my team about the state of my head, as opposed to hiding the fact that he was really struggling from mental health issues. And I just love that so much. And creating that open honesty and where people can really be themselves is what we need to do in work, regardless of what we're going through right now. And I think in a way, to your point, we can be even more connected doing that virtually, because we're having much bigger and almost giving each other more time and longer conversations. So I think that's really, really important, that if anyone says, you know, how are you? You ask again, no, really, how are you? Because most people that say they're fine, they're not. You know, as Mark Evans always says to me, be kind. Everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. And I truly believe that.
Continuing the theme of leadership, you have mentioned this, but I want to turn it round to talk about you, the importance of authenticity. You know, a modern leader doesn't have to be completely invincible. And one of the things that you have spoken about that really touched me, because I think I expressed a similar emotion, was you spoke out once very profoundly and very confidently about the fact that you suffer from imposter syndrome. How did it feel to actually first say that, and how's it been since?
I love that. So the first time I said that out loud to an audience was actually to a 300 strong crowd. So, you know, it wasn't, you know, a quick sort of quiet foray into that. But the fact is, most of us suffer from imposter syndrome. Some of us don't know what it is, and some of us don't want to talk about it. And I think the only way that we can help each other and truly be ourselves is to be open and honest. And imposter syndrome, for those of people that don't know that are listening, is purely the idea that we've got to where we've got to through luck, not abilities. And when you actually say that definition, people go, oh, yeah, me too. So most of us suffer. We just don't talk about it. And that's the challenge with most things in life. We are happy to talk about these things or to hide them behind closed doors, but not actually in an open forum. So one of my friends, Ali Hannan, as I'm sure you know her really well, who runs Creative Equals, a wonderful woman, asked me to take a quite an intimate format that we do for the Marketing Society into her large flagship event, and not just do that, but then talk about something really important. And the thing was imposter syndrome. And I've never felt such big imposter syndrome than standing in front of a 300 people crowd and really saying, I'm meant to be the expert on this, but the main thing that I know is that I suffer from it. And I'm feeling it right now in a big way. And I think doing that and showing that as a leader, as the person speaking on stage, just creates that almost that sense of calm and that relief that, oh, we're all in the same boat. And the fact is, most of us, you know, I mean, they say the statistics are 70%, but I think they're higher than that. Because unless you have feelings of empathy, stroke, sociopath, psychopath, most of us are in that same place. Most of us have those feelings. They manifest in different ways. It may not be the exact definition, but those self-limiting beliefs, those things that hold you back. And the only way we're going to overcome them is by talking about it. And by not, A, first of all, acknowledging it, B, talking about it, and C, and this is what our whole agenda is about, showing up and being brave, feeling the fear and doing it anyway. And that's the only way we're going to control it. They're never going to go completely because it's there and it makes us who we are, but it will allow us to quieten it in order to be at our best more of the time, as I talked about earlier. So I'm really pleased that I talked about it, and the amount of notes and letters and people coming up to me at events that have said, oh my goodness, I didn't know what it was, but this has helped me so much. Or I've known about it for ages, but I always thought I had to hide it because it's almost like a dirty secret. But actually, we're all in it together and we can all help each other and we can all learn from each other. And that's what it's all about. So I'm going to continue to talk about these subjects that matter for anyone that wants to be able to do that, because I genuinely believe that the way forward is together, and it's together we're better and together we're stronger. And that couldn't be more apt right now in the times that we're facing.
Well, thank you for doing that. You genuinely inspired me to talk a bit more about it. And in fact, you've stimulated a conversation with some other of my friends who are also, you know, in their small way, leaders of organizations. And I think it's all about the authenticity thing. And you epitomize that. So please continue to do that. And I want you to continue to doing it into your next job, because Gemma, you're leaving us. Yeah. So, I mean, the first question is, what are you going to miss about the Marketing Society when you do leave us?
Oh, I'm going to miss so much about the Marketing Society. And believe me, it's bittersweet to leave. I just know it's the right time for me at this stage of my career and my life. The number one thing I'm going to miss is the people, particularly my team. My team are just incredible. And I mean my team, the headquarters in London, in Teddington, but also the wider global team, all my chairs, the boards. We really are this brilliant community of people who are achieving some really good things together. So I'm going to miss that. I'm going to miss my inner team, my leadership team. We do so much together and we rely and we support each other. I'm going to miss the people, the members, but I say I'm going to miss the members. I'm still going to know them. It's like people come up to me at events and they're like, I know you're leaving us, but will I still be able to keep in touch? Of course, I'm still here. I still live in Twickenham. I'm still going to be in the industry. I'm just doing a different thing. And my new business and my existing business, both of them are all centered around the power of people and connections and relationships. So I don't think I'll miss the people as much, because people are still going to be there, but I'll for sure miss the team. Secondly, I'll miss the platform to be able to take things like the Brave Agenda into a global scale. I genuinely believe that the Marketing Society has a real role and responsibility to lead our industry forward and talk about the things that matter, so together we can start addressing our challenges and get better and braver and achieve more. And that platform is unprecedented. And I know people hate the word unprecedented right now, but I can't stop saying it, quite frankly, and I quite like it. but that platform is unrivaled, and I'll miss that, but I'll find another way as we go forward. And I'll also miss the events, bringing people together. We do some incredible events. I mentioned earlier 120, you know, but really cool dinners where we get together and share challenges and talk about issues that are facing marketers today, to the fishbowls where we tackle a really big subject like mental health, to the conferences where we have that global stage to really get inspired. I'll miss all of that, but I'll be doing different things in different ways in my new stuff, which will probably build on some of the things that I've learned at the Marketing Society. So I'm going to miss it, but also I'm really, really excited about my next challenge.
So as our leader, you've been lucky to work alongside some other great leaders. And come on, you know what I'm going to ask you. From the great marketers that you've worked with, what have you learned from them? What are you going to take into the rest of your career?
Oh, God, I've learned so much, and I've learned so much from so many people. But I think the traits that are consistent in the great leaders is what I'll take on to the next phase. So, you know, I think of brilliant leaders like Syl Salla, Chris Satterthwaite, the chief exec of Chime, Stephen Mayer, Steve Radcliffe. All of these people I mention have one thing in common, and well, many things in common, but the number one thing is that they're human and they're real. And I think that is so important as leaders, to be, to use your language earlier, authentic, to be yourself. So I'll always take that on. Years ago, I used to think, oh, you know, if I'm myself, I'm not going to be good enough. Actually, no, warts and all, that's what you get whether you like it or not, it's about being yourself. And I truly believe it's when you are your real self that you'll be your best self. So number one thing I'll take is that. The other thing that all those leaders have in common is that they're up to something. They've got plans, they've got ambition, they've got energy, and that's me, and it's what I love to do. So I'll always be up to something. I'll take on, you know, that ability to be a role model. You know, as leaders, we have responsibility to give back. And I remember when I first asked to, you know, someone asked if I'd mentor them, I remember thinking, I'm not good enough to mentor you. You know, I'm just me. And actually, a friend of mine said, you need to get over yourself, because you have to give back. You know, you've got to this stage in your career, and it's now time. Don't worry about your own confidence, your own imposter syndrome. Actually, know what you've got. Think about the evidence you've got and what you can give back. So I think as leaders, we need to be role models for others to really help light their paths. I think I've learned that we're better together. So it's all about, as leaders, as humans, coming together and achieving great things. And I've learned, if you believe something, you've got to go for it, and you've got to be brave. And even if other people are saying no, if you believe in it and it's in your instincts, it's in your heart, then you've got to jump in and do it anyway. You know, and the other thing I've learned actually is I've learned some things the hard way through the community, through leaders, is that when you're on that stage, when you're in that public profile, everyone has an opinion. And some people can be cruel with their opinions, actually. And some people can be positive and brilliant. And I think what I've learned is not everyone is going to agree with you. Not everyone is going to be aligned with your thinking. But I really believe in Brené Brown's way of saying it, that it's only when you show up, it's only when you're courageous and you're brave that you actually achieve anything. So I've learned that feedback, as much as it's a gift, it's a gift with positive intent. And I've learned that I've got to, regardless of what's been thrown at me, and I really think of that Theodore Roosevelt quote. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's my favourite quote in the world. You know, the man, I've got quite a lot of favourite quotes, but this particular one, the man in the arena, you know, I'd rather be bloody scarred and in the arena fighting the fight than the spectators that are there throwing their peanuts at you effectively. I'd rather die daring greatly than not trying at all. And that's what I've learned, that if you believe in something, if you want to achieve something, you've just got to go for it. You've just got to jump in, and you've just got to be brave. That's when you can achieve some great things and have an impact. And that's what I've learned from leaders, is having an impact is so important. And any organization that I've been to or go to, and I'm not planning on going to any organizations because, as you know, I'm starting my own business, but I want to have an impact, and I want to have an impact at scale and do some really good things that help the organization, but also others.
I know you will continue to have a big impact, and I know we'll keep in touch. Yeah, you haven't gone yet, but I want to fast forward to your last day, and here we are doing a video chat. So I'm handing you a digital post-it note. What are you going to write on the post-it note to stick on the desk for your successor?
What an amazing question. I would say you have something incredibly special to lead in your hands. You have an incredible team to support. You achieve everything you need to. You will be amazing, because if we've chosen them as our my successor, I've already interviewed some brilliant people with Craig, our chair, and they're going to be better than me. And I'm going to say, you're going to be better. You're going to be more, you know, better, more courageous than me. But the biggest thing is, be yourself. Encourage others to be themselves. And go for it, and be brave, and jump in. I just think that person is going to be on a journey, and it's going to be a privilege for them. It's been the biggest honor for me to lead such an incredible organization, and I know it will be for them. And any support that they need from me and beyond, they have it.
Sage advice there from outgoing Marketing Society Chief Executive Gemma Greaves. And Gemma, whoever takes over from you will have a lot to live up to. And personally, I'm really looking forward to the success of your new venture. So all the best, and I know we'll keep in touch. Also this week, Paul and Karen met behavioural scientist Dr. Simon Moore, the CEO of a really interesting business called Innovation Bubble. And it's a company made up entirely of psychologists, and they bring their psychological skills into our worlds of advertising and marketing. And Paul began by asking Simon for a layman's definition of behavioural science.
You've got behavioural science, and then you've got behavioural economics, and then you've got nudge theory. And I think people put them all in the same pot. And if I can just spend maybe 30 seconds to pick them apart a little bit. So behavioural science, I suppose, is the sort of more powerful of the cousins, because it employs sort of psychology to look at what might be happening, the reality of things, before it decides how it might intervene. Whereas behavioral economics is purely looking at bias, so how the brain kind of harbors lots of kind of decision biases. And it will have a, to be fairly crude, it will have a book of nudges and biases that it will look through and kind of apply them as it sees fit. So it's more of an action kind of science, whereas the behavioral science point of view is that let's do the homework as well as the output. And then you've got nudge theory, which is again a little spin-off from the behavioral economics, and that is again looking at how you might use a more finite set of biases to kind of cause change, really.
So have you got any, I guess, that come to mind, a really good example that puts your kind of what you've just explained, or brings to life what you've just explained, from a recent case study or one of your existing clients?
I've got one that's actually quite counterintuitive when you first explain it. So we worked with an online gaming client, and they were told, and there's no drum roll because it won't be a shock when I tell you what they were told. They were told that people kind of gamble and game because it's all about excitement. And you kind of think, okay, that sounds logical. So their agencies kind of work with them about how they position and frame this kind of strategy in terms of the brand positioning and then the media outputs. They then lost 14% of their market. And you can imagine the head scratching that was going on. Hang on a second. We kind of did some homework with some customers. We got a brand strategy agency in to tell us what was happening. And we thought we had it locked down. And actually, we've kind of shot ourselves in the foot here. What's going on here? So the problem is that what we know about people in general, me included, is that we often are unable to describe why we make decisions or why we're doing something, because 90%, this is actually quite shocking, 90% of what we do, we're not really aware of why we're doing it. And certainly if I asked you to say, why did you do that, you would give me quite superficial post-rationalized answers. So with this client, for example, we kind of dug down a little bit and actually found out, so their target market were 18 to 27 year old males who would spend about £30 a month on some kind of sports event. So not big gamblers by any means. So if you look at their work lives, their decisions that they're making, they're second guess the boss, and they're trying to fit in with their co-colleagues as well. So they might have decided on a 7, but their kind of boss wants a 2 and their colleagues want a 5. So they end up with a 6. So they lose control there. There's no sense of ownership in terms of their problem solving ability there. You move it to personal life, oh my goodness, it's even worse. You know, they want a 9, their partner wants a 3, they end up with a 5. Again, there's no sense of self-esteem, kind of control status there. So they've turned to gaming because it's an area that they can actually exert their own control over. They own it. They own the outcome. They own what they want to do. So this is why they're kind of, it's not about, excitement is the actual after effect of what they do. It's not the real reason, the trigger for why they go into it. So if you then position the brand to say, actually, let's stop saying bet on the next goal, bet on the next yellow card, and these are the odds. Let's just say we're here to take your kind of odds on what you want to do next. And when we did that, and when we worked with the media company, and it was actually a major football event, they were the only brand that took this different tact. They suddenly gained 28% of the market. Because, you know, people, if you ask people, they say, well, I gamble for excitement, because that's an acceptable answer, isn't it? And that's one that we probably understand that everyone will kind of listen to. If you dig, though, if you lift the stones up and dig underneath, there are other reasons why we do stuff. And we're not really, as a, you know, individual, aware of why we do it. So that's a pretty good example of a counterintuitive output I mean, I can still remember the faces of the executive board when I went in and said, right, it's all about control. And you can imagine people, what are you talking about? Gambling, control? No way. But then when you kind of play it out and do it, and then obviously you had these effects, I think it kind of justified the kind of the method in the end.
Probably an obvious one. It'd be interesting to see where you think it happens most and to most impact. But outside of kind of our bubble, which we very much live within, and within marketing and advertising, where do you see kind of behavioural science having the most effect?
The employee experience is another area, again, about how you understand kind of, particularly right now, you know, how people work in a different space. You've got lots of culture changes, workspace changes. How do you look at what's impacting their well-being, productivity, engagement? That's another area that we kind of get involved in. I mean, customer experience is definitely another area. So you're looking at complaints and loyalty schemes. You've mentioned health, government services, energy is another one. How do you get people to switch? That's a really interesting one. Mortgages is a good one as well. Insurances. So again, look, anything really. But we've kind of worked on all that. I mean, I originally started off with dolphins and monkeys, not trying to get them to switch their energy, but generally speaking, how we look at their behavior and how we switch it from a conservation kind of very contained environment to kind of the release really out into the wild.
I mean, that would be very impressive if you managed to get a dolphin to change their utilities.
Yeah, well, you can imagine it, can't you? The dolphin saying, well, I'm sure this kind of waters can be heated from more efficiently with another company.
That would be a hell of a case study for you to dine out for, I'm sure.
You can't ignore the ginormous elephant in the room, which is the current crisis that we are experiencing. And that has been, well, certainly very topical for us as an agency as well. We've been talking to a lot of our clients about, you know, how do brands behave in a time like this? Because it does feel completely unprecedented. And a big part of that comes down to, we like to be as insight-driven as possible. We like to understand what our consumer mindsets are, which is why we're so fascinated about what you do. But a big part of that means we need to understand how consumers are behaving at this time and before we can understand how we need to behave as brands. So we wanted to get your point of view on what your observations are about consumer behavior in the midst of the COVID-19 crisis and how people might be behaving differently.
One of the ones is, it sounds obvious, so it's kind of loss of control. Okay, yeah. I mean, everyone's experiencing this at the moment. So the trouble with loss of control is that it leads to stress and anxiety. So what happens to humans and their decision-making systems when they kind of experience this kind of stress is that they switch mindsets. So they become very convergent. In other words, they become very narrow-minded and they go into a hunker-down mentality. In a nutshell, what that basically means for brands is they are less open to new ideas and change. So one of the big things I would suggest is they are not going to listen to new propositions at this time. They've gone from a gain to a maintain mentality. They want to know how you're going to help them keep what they've got and be safe and secure in the resources that they already have. They're not really going to be open to new things. So that's one thing I would suggest. The other thing that's interesting is they're going to switch to a much more gut intuitive feeling point of view. So the way they make decisions, they're not going to be very considered at the moment, which sounds quite funny, doesn't it? But the fact is, when you're stressed and anxious, you're kind of spinning those anxiety stress plates and you want to get rid of that. So all your attention's going on managing that. As a consequence, anything else that comes in will be given a very quick intuitive once over. So in other words, we're going to rely on very much now non-conscious cues about, how is that making me feel? I look at that very quickly, that message. It's not for me, it's for me. It's making me feel comfortable, not making me feel comfortable. So one of the things that I think brands really need to do their homework on now is, what are the non-conscious triggers of their target audiences in terms of engagement and disengagement? What can you do very quickly that will actually make people pay attention and drop a plate that they're already spinning, or, you know, or not actually put a barrier up to say that you're just not relevant to them? So that's one area I think, again, needs some work. Unfortunately, the other thing is that stress makes you more critical as well. So this is quite bad news for brands, and they need to think about this a little bit more carefully. Just from an evolutionary point of view, our brains are wired to attend and watch out for negative stimuli four times more than positive. So let me give you an example. Those people in relationships, you wake up one morning and you're fairly smug. You've done some nice things for your partner. You've got kudos in the bank. An hour goes by and all of a sudden you've done something irritating. You don't even know what it is probably. But what happens to that kudos? It just evaporates. Okay, you don't do one irritating thing and then you cross off one nice thing. All the nice things go because the brain gives undue attention to the negative. So I think one of the things that brands can be doing at the moment is doing some spring cleaning. Okay, given the fact that people are in that kind of negative space mindset and they are critical, irritating things that you offer or do for them are going to become even more irritating at this time. So rather than start thinking about, oh, let's offer a new product or let's give a new service out, I think your money should be on removing the sort of little bumps in the road that you already have and doing some house cleaning up of what is irritating the customer. Do some research. What could I make better? What could I make less irritating? So do some homework here. I think there's money to be kind of spent on this. We'll pay great dividends in the long run because you're talking about relationships with people. Okay, if you lose people, you've lost them. And given the fact that people are going to be very critical at the moment, that's just the way the mindset is. Everything's quite negative. So they're going to be in a negative mindset. So they're going to be looking, they're going to respond quite positively if you can make things a little bit nicer for them.
Certainly from a personal point of view, I can definitely relate to those, you know, those feelings of loss of control and the fact that it's making me feel very stressed and anxious. And it does, it just means that your headspace for any extra information is much, much smaller. And that's exactly the type of thing that we're trying to help our clients navigate through, because I think there is a real debate around obviously you still want to have a presence, and there's a lot of literature at the moment around the fact that you shouldn't lose your brand presence or saliency because that could cost you in the long run, but with good reason and based on everything that you're saying, yes, you might still want to have a presence in the mind of consumers, but you actually have to be a lot more careful than you maybe think about what the cost of that is going to be.
The way that consumer behavior is likely to change, and maybe what marketeers can learn from this, is the fact that, you know, there's an emphasis needs away from them. I mean, look, brands, they work quite closely on their stuff. They're quite proud of their stuff. And of course, they want to tell people about it. You know, however, there's at this time, that's probably not the thing to do. So, you know, they need to kind of move away from talking about them and talking about the customer. So think about going on a date. Imagine if someone just talked at you all the time about them. It's not very attractive, is it, really? And it probably doesn't mean you're going to get a second date out of it either. So brands need to think about how they turn it around a little bit. Because you know, what can you do for them at this time? Not what you can't is another message, I would say. And then I think you kind of alluded to the fact about what should be the voice in terms of certain brands. I think that there's some confusion out there. So I think brands that are silent run a real psychology risk here of coming across as underconfident.
Okay.
Now, what I'm saying is, I don't mean to say that you just need to churn out lots of stuff that's irrelevant, but I think just saying silent as a strategy is probably not good psychologically at the moment, because it alludes to the fact that because you've got nothing to say, you may not be relevant. So, I mean, let's use a Zoom analogy. So lots of people are doing Zoom calls at the moment. And, you know, if someone doesn't say something on the call, probably non-consciously you're thinking, well, they've got nothing to contribute, have they? Are they still on this call? So, and that's what brands have got to try not to do. And they've got to get a balance between doing too much that's irrelevant with doing, you know, doing something. They need to say something because, you know, it's just being quiet is not good psychologically in terms of that kind of perception of, they don't seem to say much, so I don't really trust that they know what they're doing, really. So, and then the other area I'd say is, this is a really big one, and this is quite potent. Brands need to lead with emotional messages, not facts and figures, unfortunately, which sounds really counterintuitive right now. And the government is doing all sorts of things in the wrong psychology space about giving facts and figures to people. The thing is that the part of the brain that deals with facts and figures is one-fifth the size of the part of the brain that deals with emotions. Now, I'm not a gambling person, but I would imagine those odds would suggest that the emotional message is going to actually hit home more than the factual based message. So, you know, we always advise brands when they lead with things like price and numbers and quality and quantity. They're important, but they're not the first thing that persuades people to engage with you. Let's look at a pair of glasses. Factually, why do people need glasses? They need glasses to see. That's a fact. They want to see better. Now, if it was just a fact-based argument, we would only need one pair of glasses. Yeah, because that's it. We just want to see better. However, how many different pairs of glasses are there out there? There are loads. If you go in a room with 9 people who've got glasses, I bet you won't even see the same pair of glasses. That's how kind of divergent the kind of design of glasses are. And that's because the emotional connection is outplaying the factual. People want to look sexy, intelligent, not stupid. They're more important than actually being able to see. There are lots of people who need glasses who won't even wear them. You know, on an emotional level, it's far more important, and it works far better. There's more ROI in actually understanding what the emotional triggers are rather than the actual factual. So that's another piece of advice I would say to marketeers. The other point about that is if you keep throwing numbers at people, you know, it stresses them out. I've got to remember that number. I've got to, what does it mean? How do I compare that number? I've got to remember 17 you told me. And what was the other brand that told me? They told me, oh, I can't remember now. So you're adding to the stress of people as well. And also the last thing about facts and figures is you're not being differential. Everyone is shouting numbers at the moment. Yeah. And if everyone, I don't know about you, but if 7 people shout numbers at me, I would find that quite stressful. Because I would think, well, you're all shouting numbers at me. Which number's important? I can't remember some of your numbers. I don't even know if some of your numbers are accurate or not. So actually, I'm just going to shut down and not even bother. One of my bugbears is assumption. Okay. So a lot of brands, you talk to a lot of brands and they go, no, we've done loads of research. We know what the customer is. There are lots of brands, of course, who haven't done any research for customers, which is actually quite shocking. But you know, if you're going to build a house, you probably want to know what you're building it on. My analogy is, look, what, you know, rather than come just put your hand in the wind and think, oh, I hope I'm building my house and I hope I'm not building it on sand, spend a little bit of money. It's not a huge budget to find out about people, but spend some money and do your homework. It's almost like an insurance. Work out what emotionally do these people need. Is it control? Is it status? Is it social integration? So we've just worked with a massive big retail brand who weren't doing very well a couple of years ago. And we've just used our psychology to look at the insights and actually draw out the emotional triggers of what the customers need. I got a phone call last week to say, we've just done some A/B testing for 6 months on what you did. Our sales have gone up 50%. And that's just based on the emotional understanding of what the customer needs. We didn't move price. We didn't do anything with their copy in terms of the pragmatics. It was just the emotional story that connected them with a pair of shoes, a suit, a belt, for example. So emotions can be really quite impactful.
I know the kind of mental health advice is to take things one day at a time at the moment, but we can't help but wonder how consumer behavior is likely to be changed for the long term and by what's happening, if at all, and what marketers might learn from it.
I hope this is going to be a life lesson in moving away from assumption. I think a lot of brands have been caught out in what they've assumed about the behavior and what's relevant to consumers, and it's worked out that it hasn't been. So I think in the future, there's that little bit of investment about research about what customers need. Definitely control. So the worst thing that can happen when all this kind of dies down is for brands to kind of tread on their size 12 boots on the customer. So I know brands are feeling a little bit out of control. What we don't want them to do is suddenly, once we're all free to go back to normal, is suddenly then go, hooray, right, come on, let's kind of really kind of get to grips and get under control. I want these consumers back under control again. Yeah. They're going to get a backlash from that because the consumers want the control as well. So they've been, you know, out of control for a while. So there's going to be a balance between the two. So it's all very well to give the consumers that they have the perception that they're in control, but what they don't want to see is that's being taken away from them. I mean, this works quite well in finance. So you'll have a section of people who, you know, who write lists. They won't want to go to a party unless they know who's going to the party. So that, you know, they like to be in control. The worst thing a finance company can say to that person is, "We'll be smart with your money." Mm. They're like, "No, I don't want you to be smart with. I want to be smart with my money. I just want you to help me be smart with my money." That's a better message. Yeah. So that needs to be we need to think about that as well. And I think there's going to be a shift in the consumer mentality around the needs of responsible, caring and sustainable brands as well. I think that I don't know if you've noticed, but there's been a recent spike in social activity on things like LinkedIn, you know, condemning lots of brand activity at the moment and saying that a lot of the activity is just PR based. It's just a PR spin on trying to get me to like you more and come back to you. Whereas actually, I don't actually believe what you're telling me is true. So again, we get back to this emotional understanding. How are we going to persuade people on a gut emotional level that our brand is something that they should support and kind of want to have a relationship with? Again, that's going to be something that they're going to need to kind of look about. And I think an immediately knee-jerk reaction, there's going to be, I think there's going to be what we call revenge spend. So we're going to get people who are locked down, you know, they're going to want to go out, treat themselves, almost demonstrate that they can be back in control again and make some decisions on their own. So I think you're going to get a bit of a spike originally when we kind of go out again with our kind of wallets in our pockets and purses. There's going to be a little bit of a spike about treating ourselves to stuff. Just you know, a pat on the back and a little bit of like, whoa, I need to kind of feel good again.
A big thank you to Gemma Greaves and Simon Moore for joining us on the podcast this week. Well, I hope you and your family and friends are all well and you're coping with the lockdown. We'll be back in a few weeks with another episode to discuss more ways in which we can all get through this together and try and emerge with our businesses and our lives as unscathed as possible. So stay safe and see you then. Bye-bye.